views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are going to have a really fascinating discussion about the electric universe. But before we get into that, I want to talk about our history with dealing with new paradigms when it comes to science. It's happening now in a lot of areas of science. It's why we have such a major clash on the climate debate and on vaccines and on so many areas. But this has been around for, you know, all of history, like the famous example of Galileo, who was persecuted his entire life for changing the paradigm of the Earth revolving around the sun. And then there was a more recent one this past century was Semmelweis, who introduced the notion of washing hands to eliminate the spread of disease. He had two hospitals, and he was able to reduce the death rate of newborns in his hospital from over 10% to less than 1%. And you would think people would be, you know, putting out the red carpet for him. But instead of him being granted the Nobel Prize for one of the most important discoveries in medicine, he ended up being thrown into an insane asylum, beaten down, and ultimately suffered an unfortunate death because of this paradigm-changing idea, which threatened the status quo. It threatened the egos of the doctors who were in the other hospitals, feeling that they were going to be blamed for all these deaths, and that can't be them because they are so smart, the smartest people of the time, and they would lose power and possibly money. So this has been the curse of scientists with new ideas and new paradigms. Well, it's happening now. We are shutting people out when it comes to cancer research. There's a standard protocol that's by law. So if you have other ideas and other things that are working, they shut you out. And they do that on a lot of things. The vaccine debate, which is ridiculous. They are saying that anybody that's saying that autism is, you know, caused by vaccines. I don't know what's happening with the autism and vaccines, but what I do know is that we haven't tested what happens when you take multiple vaccines at the same time. We know that grapefruit, for example, interferes with certain medications. Why wouldn't a couple of vaccines at a time interfere with each other and cause problems? They haven't done the research. They haven't done the studies. So they can't say that the quacks who think that autism is causing the vaccines is causing autism. They can't say that they're quacks if they haven't done the research. It's just not fair. And that's happening in so many areas of our society. And one is this electric universe. And they have been having great results in labs. A lot of electrical engineers and formal groups are working on this and finding that these theories are actually proving out in the labs. So there's some merit to this idea, and they have yet to get any mainstream scientists to openly debate this, which I think is very unfortunate because so much is learned through the open science debate. We figure out and we flesh out the flawed theories. Everybody learns. It can get, you know, heated, but that's what we debate things for, so that we can figure out where the truth lies. Science should be objective, and you just figure out the flaws and you figure out what's right and wrong and you move on. But we can't evolve as a society if we don't allow these debates to go on. And if there is merit, instead of having our ego bruised or, you know, somebody challenging our authority, and we allow that as a society, which is just crazy, we should make sure we encourage open scientific debate, because that's how we grow and advance as a species. So I am not going to talk too much more. I want to get Wallace Thornhill on the program. He is the chief scientist and a physicist with the Thunderbolt Project, which is the group that are working to get the ideas of this electric universe out there so people can understand what this is about. It has huge potential as far as it's going to be paradigm changing, but it'll also usher in a new way of looking at all sorts of problems. And if their theories prove out to be correct in a mass scale, which is starting to look like they are, it will take the shackles and the anchors off what we're doing already, because the other theories aren't, there's always problems, there's flaws, and it's keeping us from getting to that next level of technology, especially when it comes to space and travel and those kinds of things. So let's get Wallace Thornhill on the program.
Hi, Wall. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for the call, Sarah.
I'm really excited to talk to you because, like so many other people, once you dive into Velikovsky and all these ancient stories, you start to, and then I started hearing some of the stuff that you had, and it gets really interesting. And so I wanted to ask you, I'm really glad we're talking. I have a whole bunch of questions to ask you. So first of all, let's get into this. What is the difference between the mainstream view of the universe versus your view of the universe?
Well, the mainstream story is really a child's fairy story. It's made, in my opinion, more to make us feel comfortable than anything. In other words, everything happened way, way in the past and we don't have to worry about too much today. It's all been wound up like clockwork and we can feel quite safe. And there's a good reason for that, I think, when we talk about Velikovsky later and the past of the Earth and the human race. But the major scientific difference between the mainstream view and the electric universe is the difference in emphasis on the forces that act to form galaxies and run our solar system, so to speak. The mainstream rely on gravity, which is the weakest force known. It is 1,000 billion times weaker than the electric force. And yet the electric force appears nowhere in cosmology. You can look it up in the backs of encyclopedias and so on and books on astronomy, and you won't find any mention of electricity or electric currents, anything to do with it, which when you think about it is really weird.
Well, especially when you look at what Tesla did that we have, we're our hearts and our brain is made up of a lot of electrical pulses. So there's something more going on, right? We know the Earth has electrical something going on. Well, you know even more. I mean, you have all these equations that you're going to talk about. But even at the basic level, we know that. That means, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course the space race allowed us to find out that space is electrical too. But all that the astronomers are willing to deal with is magnetism. And as one leading astronomer here in Australia said at a meeting I was at, for other scientists, by the way, it wasn't for the public, when we don't understand something, we blame it on magnetism. And that gives you some clue as to the limitations of modern astrophysics and astronomy. But this goes much further. Once you allow electrical effects, then you turn and have a look around and see if anyone else is working on that, and you find that there is another cosmology, and it's supported by one of the largest professional organizations in the world, the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and they have a subchapter which looks at electric cosmology and the activity of electricity in
because they understand it.
Because they understand it and they've experimented with it and they can see the things they see in the laboratory, it turns out, you can actually scale up and see the same effects out there in space on the galactic scale. Now, that means that their work is where you look first before you start inventing dark matter and dark energy and all this other nonsense that's required merely to save the appearances of astrophysics. Once you've sort of tied yourself down with that weakest force in the universe, it means that everywhere in space where you see highly energetic things going on, you have to invent matter and densities and things which are just beyond all reason and beyond all experience.
Well, isn't it true, and we're going to get into this a little bit later, but isn't it true that the equations all start working when you look at it like this? You don't have to make fudge factors. You don't have to. Everything just starts to work, which is an indication that you're on more of a right path.
Absolutely. The problem with astrophysics is that it deals with a few photons from great distances, and from that all sorts of assumptions are added, and you come up with all of these stories about how things work out there, but there's no way of testing it. There's no real way of testing gravitational theory because the force is so weak. And the difference between that and the electrical theory is that, as I said, the plasma scientists can actually perform experiments to test their ideas and run simulations on supercomputers, which is done in a physical sense. It's not just putting equations in that somebody's dreamt up. It's using basic physics of electricity and magnetism. And they can show that it works. You can actually produce spiral galaxies without the need for dark matter. And it even shows you how stars and galaxies are formed electromagnetically, not gravitationally. So once you have made these fundamental shifts in perception, everything changes. And this is the thing. The electric universe changes everything. Our understanding of not only the objects like planets and stars and our existence on this Earth, but life itself.
Well, and I think our ability to move forward quicker in our understanding, if we get a construct that is clean and the equations work, and it everything will go quicker, right? I mean, we won't have those obstacles. So before we get really deep into this, what is your role in this movement? And what do you call it first? The Electric Universe, right? It's the Lightning Bolt Project. Is that accurate? And what
the
is your role?
Right.
The Thunderbolt.
Yes.
I'm sorry. The Thunderbolt. Same thing, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. The Thunderbolts Project. There's a special reason for calling it that, and that is that the Electric Universe was born from an examination of the entire past history of the human race and their observations of the sky. And those observations don't fit with the present sky. And what's happened is that people have therefore misinterpreted things that were passed down for thousands of years orally by some cultures. And it's amazing. I look at the Aboriginal, Australian Aboriginal stories, and you find that their stories are more accurate than ones that were produced by committees of old men in later civilizations. You know, in other words, they've been untouched. And that helps us to be pretty certain that our reconstructions of what happened in the past are correct. The common theme between the stories of the past and their dramatic stories of the apocalyptic behavior of the planets and their favorite weapon, which was the thunderbolt, that was the clue to the physics of the universe. In other words, the ancients witnessed electrical events in the sky, which we have never seen and wouldn't even understand if we saw them today, except that we now have the scientists in Los Alamos and places like that where they have the highest energy electrical experiments on Earth, where they actually destroy the laboratory partially in their experiments. It's that powerful. They see the things in those laboratories which the ancients scratched onto rock surfaces and passed down in the form of Zeus's thunderbolt, which doesn't look like a lightning strike at all. It looks like a football, a corkscrew football. In the laboratory, what do we see? A corkscrew-shaped football.
Oh, interesting. That's fun. So what did you observe about in the myths and things that really got you interested in this? And you talked a little bit about the apocalypse, that all these different, but can you go into that a little bit more? Because it's very interesting.
It certainly is. I was inspired by a book that was brought home to me by my father, who was in a military hospital at the time, and it was called Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky. Well, that book was the bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list for 6 months in 1950, and yet the publisher, and it was a technical book publisher because it was written, although it was in a popular style, it was fully footnoted and documented. That company was forced to burn the book by scientists. They were so hostile. It was quite irrational, the outbursts, particularly by some at Harvard, including Harlow Shapley. And a lot of them boasted they hadn't read the book. They just knew it was wrong because it disobeyed Newton's laws, as if Newton's law, which is a man-made version of what's going on in space, is the final answer. You know, this, we get hung up on things and set up roadblocks for ourselves in understanding by putting people on pedestals and calling their laws universal laws when they're nothing of the sort. Mm-hmm. And Belikovsky opened my eyes because he showed you can actually use a so-called forensic technique to go back and look at a disaster scene and piece together what happened. And that disaster scene included something which, of course, Shapley and the people like him just couldn't stand, and that was that a planet-sized comet was played a central role in all of the events which were described, the apocalyptic events. You know, we faced doomsday, that's the point. And the human race was decimated in what happened. So you can understand that today we suffer a kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome globally. And this accounts for a lot of our strange and irrational behavior. And that's important too. And that was a feature of Velikovsky's final works, and that was the significance of this to the human race and our future survival. Anyway, to get back to it, Velikovsky's story really resonated for me because I could see that you could have a much broader view of science. You could look at the humanities, you could look at history and so on, and piece together a much more dynamic and interesting story than was allowed by the peaceful story of Newtonian clockwork. So that was my inspiration at high school. Now, I had this problem, of course, that I thought, now, how can all these scientists and my teachers be so wrong? And I talked to some of the teachers at school, and they didn't seem interested. I couldn't believe it. So I read the book again before I went to the university because I was going to tackle the lecturers and people there and ask them questions. But I soon found out you don't do that at university. Unless you conform, you're in trouble. And so I behaved myself and got through and was accepted for postgraduate research in upper atmosphere research, which is the closest to space I could get at that time. And halfway through that year, I tossed it in and joined IBM, decided I had to work on my own. And so it's been a fairly lonely journey, but at the same time, one of the most exciting adventures anyone could ever have, and that is the adventure of discovery.
And you have found in your discovery that there's a lot of scientists or some pretty good scientists in the past that came before you that came up with these ideas as well. Can you explain that?
That's true. One of the things that science education suffers from today is that there's no real historical perspective to it. Unless things were invented in the last few years, you don't hear much about it. And the things you do hear about are mostly couched in a sense that they sprang from nowhere, like Einstein and his theory of relativity. It's just not true. In fact, if you want to, in my opinion, if you want to excite students to do science again, give them some perspective and look at the battles that went on and the way the decisions were made about who was right and who was wrong. And you find out it's some of the most arcane.
It's worse than
ordinary politics because most of it is out of sight. It's unaccountable. I know people who've lost their jobs at universities for subscribing to some of these ideas, and that's just terrible. I mean, it's supposed to be about open discussion and investigation and so on. It's just not like that, unfortunately. That's the ideal of the scientific method. But the scientific method is honored more in, in breaking it or at least not conforming to it. Somebody once said there's as many scientific methods as there are scientists. In some senses, that's true. There are different ways of doing science, and the way I do it is not like anyone else I know of.
And how would you say that differs? How do you do it different from how other scientists or universities do it?
Well, having this historical background, when I was at university, I was the only science student, as far as I know, who spent a lot of time in the shelves of the anthropology section of the library, pulling books off the shelf, somewhat random, just to check whether Velikovsky had been had a case to answer or whether he'd been cherry-picking his data. And it didn't take me long to find out that he hadn't cherry-picked it at all. You know, these books just sprang to life when I opened them up. I could understand exactly what they were talking about. And that was a good test, I felt. When you say there are a lot of scientists, in looking back in history, you can see when you look at these controversies that there were people who had the right ideas, but they were either sidelined, forgotten about, or they didn't win the argument because they didn't have the political clout. And this happened with Einstein too. You know, the phenomenon of Einstein was all about show business and nothing to do with science, really, when you look back, because some of the arguments against him were very powerful and should have carried more weight than that of the prestige in that some people feel when they can couch things in terms that no one else seems to understand. You know, there's a certain cachet about sounding really obscure and erudite. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that on the media these days.
Well, it's just too bad that we can't have open debate on things and keep growing and going forward as a human race. I wouldn't think that physics and science would be so bad. Like, you lose your job and everything else just because you're trying to figure things out. And debating things and have theories that make sense. I mean, if you were coming from left field and the formulas didn't work out and somebody could show that it didn't work out, then okay, that's one thing. But if you're showing that all these theories and all these formulas and all these things are working out, why am I being criminalized and demonized for putting together a theory that makes sense? You know, it's something that's what education should be about. That's what scientific debate should be about. It is thinking people, smart people coming together with theories that make sense. Now, if they can show you that your proofs, your stuff doesn't make sense, then that's great. That's what we're looking for, because you're a very open-minded person, right? I mean, that's how you got to where you are. So come forward and show you why your proofs don't make sense or why your mathematical equations don't make sense. But until then, it's not right to treat you any different than any other scientist.
No. One of the things I should do is make it clear that mathematics isn't science. So I operate from the other end, and that is the natural philosophy end, where you inductively try and figure out what's going on. I'm very good at figuring out how things work, you know. I taught myself to repair televisions and video recorders and all that kind of stuff simply because I was interested and I wanted to know. And I think the best lessons you ever learn are the ones you teach yourself. And being what one science journalist called me, the boundary rider of science, I look at the people who are creating a lot of heat and very little light in an argument to see what it is that they're saying that's causing all of this denial on the part of the establishment, or actually sometimes outright name calling, which is, you see a lot of that with the climate debate at present. And it's coming from that angle of seeing things from the broader picture and being able to put all the pieces together. I call the electric universe the big picture of cosmology, because presently cosmology is just focused on very narrow areas of research. But cosmology is supposed to be the queen of the sciences. You know, it's supposed to be the umbrella under which everything is supposed to fit. It has nothing to say about life, consciousness, all of the important things to us. It's completely divorced from our normal experience. They talk about extra dimensions. Well, that has no meaning outside mathematics. It delves into strange forms of matter, and they use words which have no meaning. Even words like, would you believe, mass is not understood, matter is not understood, gravity is not understood, magnetism is not understood. All they've got are equations that describe what they observe at these things to do and how they behave. But at the fundamental level, we are ignorant. Our science is built on no foundations. The electric universe tries to put the foundations underneath what it then constructs. And the beauty of that is that you can get confirmation along the way by making predictions, some of them quite outrageous, and then having them confirmed, which sort of helps you to be sure that your foundation is sound. And I think the greatest accolade I get is from people who write to me and say, I've always been interested in astronomy and cosmology, but having read your stuff for the first time, I understand it. And that's all that I'm concerned about. And I don't use mathematics because mathematics is sort of the backroom boy's job. They come along later, they look at the model that you've produced and they say, okay, this is the mathematical theory that we would apply to this and let's test it. But you don't use the mathematics to try and tell you what the universe is doing because mathematics is merely a way of describing it, not of explaining it.
That makes sense. It's a language. So have you been able to put everything that you're doing into a mathematical language, into the proofs? Has that been done?
Some of it has. What I rely on particularly, for instance, in the cosmology area is the plasma cosmologists, the people who've done the hard work. And there are books published on it. There's one particular one, which is the best I know, written by Anthony Perrett, who was actually worked with us for some years. It's called Physics of the Plasma Universe. And in that, anyone who wants to know the mathematics behind plasma behavior, that's the place to go. So I can point to books for people to read. If anyone wants a popular description of how this works, you read Eric Lerner's The Big Bang Never Happened, because that comes out of the plasma universe, you know, that you don't need a big bang. In fact, the whole concept is nonsense. It makes no sense whatsoever, you can say.
I just like the fact that you can look at things differently and say, okay, let's look at this and see if we can solve our understanding and some of the things that don't work out, see if this solves it. Mm. It's another piece of the puzzle. And we are looking at new paradigms don't hurt us if it makes more sense. And so I think it's important to look at these other kind of scientific debates and take an open mind and not just tear everybody down. I don't understand. Mm. But persecution of new ideas has always happened. It's in every scientific field. It's happening. Anytime you're going to change a paradigm, the new paradigm people in science get just destroyed. You can change paradigms in other areas, but you can't science. It's really, it's incredible. But can you talk a little bit more about Velikovsky? Because he was phenomenal. I mean, some of the things he came up with. And will you show how later on a lot of those things that he said that they were laughing at actually proved out to be true?
That's right. Velikovsky had the advantage that he was a polymath. He was a scholar in a number of different disciplines, and the power of his book, Worlds in Collision, was that he showed how modern science could be brought to bear to test or to look at the reports of the ancients. Like, for instance, if there is a report on one hemisphere that the sun's motion was disturbed, you know, the day the sun stood still, the biblical story, he said you would expect there would be a story which would coincide on the other side of the world, but it would have to do at night. Mm-hmm. And you have a look, and sure enough, in South America, there were stories of an extended night when the stars fell from the sky and all the forests burned. And he reported that. Well, this is the kind of thing you would expect based on modern science to have happened. So that was the technique he used. But being a trained psychologist and psychiatrist, he recognized the human problem. And this is where the history is important and the psychology. These subjects are not taught to scientists unless you specially ask for it, the physicists, I should say. The psychology of human behavior shows that we are not well adapted to do science. Because if you present somebody with an idea which is outside their belief system, their initial response is to not deny it, and then later, forget it.
Mm-hmm. Reject it.
Yeah, you reject it at first, and then you forget it. And it's accelerated forgetting. And psychologists have identified this, and there's a technique used here in Australia in some schools of, they call it remedial mediation. In other words, you show somebody that they've got something wrong, and this is the right way of doing it, but you have to repeatedly get them to think about what they're doing before they will actually accept the right way. It's a process. And it's like one that I had to go through. A lot of stuff that I was taught at school, I had to drop. And doing that was the most difficult thing. Sometimes it took years because you feel, well, I'm losing sight of shore. You know, where do I go from here? It's that kind of feeling, slightly lost. But then there's the exhilaration of an adventurer, somebody who's out there to discover things. So there's two edges to it. But Velikovsky's approach was that more of the classical scholars who had a broad education of history and the arts, literature, as well as science. And you will find that most of the major discoveries in science prior to the 20th century were made by outsiders.
Yes, that's true in every field, pretty much.
Yes, yeah, because they came with an open mind.
Yes.
An open book.
It's like children. They don't know. They just say it, yeah. And it seems like genius.
Yeah.
But that's why I
say, yeah. We could teach the electric universe beginning in primary school, no trouble. It's very easy. There's nothing difficult, and it all relates to things which we experience and know about. You don't have to talk about fairies at the bottom of the garden and that with the Big Bang. And I was just reading, my grandson, who's 6 years old, has got a book on astronomy. He seems to be very keen, and he showed it to me the other day, and I looked at it and I said, that's all nonsense. And I explained it to him in simple words because there were simple words used in the book. And he said, he got it. He said, yeah, well, but I said, don't tell your teachers that unless you can explain both sides of it, you know, otherwise you're getting into trouble.
Yeah. So, okay, but Velikovsky, he was good friends with Einstein, right? They were good friends. He had a high profile. And then Einstein kind of separated himself because he got such a huge backlash when this book came out. But what I understand, at the end of his life, when a lot of those things were starting to prove to be true, that Einstein wanted to, he was going to fund his research to prove out some of these theories, but he ended up dying. You know, he never got there.
But Einstein supported Velikovsky's contention that radio noises would be found from Jupiter. And, of course, that was shown a few years later to be correct. But Einstein died before he could use whatever influence he had to have that tested.
Which is too bad. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Velikovsky predicted a number of outrageous things, and these are the best tests. If the outrageous ideas, and more than one, prove to be correct, then you can't ignore it. And Velikovsky predicted that Venus would be found to be red hot, you know, as hot as an iron stove.
And what did they think at the time?
They thought it would be tropical. You know, they'd find animals there and it would be tropical.
Did they really? That seems laughable now, you know.
It does, yeah. And also, he said when the space shots for the moon, the Apollo missions were about to happen, that they should test for remnant magnetism in the rocks on the moon. Now, the moon is assumed not to have ever had a magnetic field. And so they should have photographed the rocks in place and their orientation so that they could test which direction the magnetic field was pointing if they still had any remnant magnetism. They didn't do that. They just picked the rocks up and put them in their collection. And later they would be surprised to discover remnant magnetism in the moon rocks. So that was another prediction of his that was shown to be, off the map, but correct. For any of these reasons, he should have been taken more seriously. Now, I think tactically, Velikovsky made some mistakes, and that was part of the problem. One was he opened up the historical front and the reconstruction of ancient history, because obviously with his background, that was of particular interest. But to open up on two fronts like that, although it was a dramatic story and well worth telling, it opened him up to attack on two fronts rather than just one.
And the other thing was, even though what he was saying makes a lot of sense and it's really, it's something we should be studying, it's just you're going to get creamed.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Get creamed one way, that's the other, but go ahead.
Yeah, the work that we've done, myself and my colleagues, who extended Velikovsky's mytho-historical forensic technique way back into the earliest memory of mankind, showed that Velikovsky overstated the case and made errors, of course, in his historical reconstruction, and that the major events occurred at the end of the last ice age. but there were echoes down through history. And of course, the appearance of a bright comet in the sky was enough to set everyone, you know, on edge and repeat the stories of the past. And consequently, a lot of historical events were couched in apocalyptic terms, but it actually referred back to an earlier time when the Earth was really threatened.
Well, and the end of the last ice age is starting to show up in a lot of archaeology and a lot of things now. They're starting to find that we really did have an apocalyptic event, and it's starting to show up all over the place.
Yes, yes. The recent discovery in America, which has started a lot of controversy, of mastodon bones that have been shattered by rocks. And, of course, the only recourse of the standard model is that somebody had to use the rocks to smash the bones. It never occurs to anyone that those rocks could have fallen from the sky and at high velocity and smashed the animals. When you look at the graveyards of the dinosaurs too, it's shattered remains. And the other aspect of all of that is that it's just assumed that animals die and they're fossilized. They're not. They're not today. It requires them to be buried before they can decay. And then there's the discovery of genetic material in dinosaur bones. That can't last for 63 million years, you know. Our whole business of radioactive dating is also based on the same story of, you know, a 5-billion-year-old solar system and a 15 or thereabouts billion-year-old universe. That's just a story, purely a story.
And what does your theory think of the age?
Well, our fascination with dinosaurs suggests that we were around when they were around. But that means that a couple of things, and the major one is that we don't understand gravity, because dinosaurs could not lift themselves off the ground in today's gravity. There's no way they could do it. They're just not built for today's Earth gravity. So the fundamental aspect of that is we don't understand gravity, and it's taken me most of my life to figure out what gravity really is. And it's very simple, and it's it has some mind-boggling implications. But it means that the ages of all of these things measured geologically are not worth the paper they're written on, because it's merely assumed that all radioactive elements decay at the same rate for 5 billion years or whatever it is, the age of the Earth. That is an assumption, and it's been shown in laboratories recently that it's not correct. The radioactive rate of decay, and that process is a mystery. Nobody knows why one particular atom suddenly decides to decay. It's a statistical event, which means it's not understood. And it means that you cannot say what the age of something is using radioactive dating. About the best you can say is that something is the same age as something else, or was buried in the same event, but you can't say an absolute date. It's been found also recently that the radioactive decay of radioactive elements on Earth changes with our relationship to the sun. So there's a connection at the matter level between the sun and the Earth, which is not understood. And this gets down to gravity. Gravity is a matter-to-matter interaction. How does one lump of matter know the other one is even there? And that gets down to what gravity is. It's an electrical force of a particular kind, very weak one, between all matter in the universe. And all of these things get back to natural philosophy then, and the ideas that were held back in the earlier centuries. And you go back and you look at Newton and you say, well, he had a friend who proposed that gravity was a repulsive force, not an attractive force. And Newton looked at that carefully, and it works. But they couldn't come up with a mechanism to, a physical mechanism to explain it. So this just goes to show that Einstein's theory involving geometry in an extra space, which there isn't any, you know, an extra dimension, is merely another geometric game. We tend to do this with mathematics. We make up games, and Einstein was good at that. There's a show on National Geographic right now with Geoffrey Rush, the Australian actor playing Einstein, and he was interviewed about his role, and he's the kind of guy who studies the person he's going to play in great detail. And he he called him a glorious daydreamer. And I would agree. He was a glorious daydreamer, but he was not a scientist. But the people who followed his work in mathematics have built up a whole structure around it, which is going to be very hard to put to one side. This is one of the problems we face, of course, but I'm not alone there. There are thousands of scientists and philosophers around the world who've recognized the fact that Einstein made some fundamental errors, even in his mathematics. And the result of that is that for the last century, science has gone nowhere. You know, we keep identifying technological advance with science, but they're not the same thing. Technology can advance without any understanding. If you can show something works in the laboratory and you can figure out a way of making money out of it or producing something that will do something for you, you can go ahead and do it, but you don't have to know how it works. Even transistors didn't require quantum mechanics. The ideas were invented before quantum mechanics. So both relativity and quantum mechanics, which doesn't explain anything either, it's just a recipe book with no understanding at the physical matter level of what's going on. These are the two things that underpin modern cosmology, and neither of them are valid insofar as they have no underpinning physical model of how they work.
Do you think that if they started looking at this seriously, that our ability to go into space and our ability to do a lot of that exploration would be on hyperdrive compared to where it is now?
Absolutely. We've gone nowhere for a century. We've got a lot of catching up to do. And my work on gravity shows that once you understand gravity, there are some interesting possibilities. And our work on the electrical nature of stars shows how stars really produce their energy and not the way that it's thought. By smashing particles together in these ultra-expensive gadgets they've been building. So we've wasted decades there as well because there's a belief that you cannot get nuclear energy other than by smashing particles together, and that's not true.
So what kind of advances do you foresee happening if we took a different approach?
Oh, well...
I'm throwing a hard one at you, but this is, you know...
Yeah. It would look like science fiction, you know, the idea of flying saucers and things like that. I can imagine that with the right materials and so on and an understanding of what gravity really is, we could reduce gravity or use it to accelerate us because, as I said, gravity is fundamentally a repulsive force and not an attractive one. It's just that we happen to live on one pole of a magnet, so it just attracts us like iron filings. But if you get away from the Earth some distance, then it's a repulsive force. And on the other hand, when it comes down to the energy that is trapped in matter and we release in our nuclear reactions, that can be handled by a very simple technique. And in fact, biological systems have learned how to do it. And that is by tuning things. You know, you just bring things together at just the right moment and bingo, you've released energy. You don't have to overcome this electrical barrier they call the Coulomb barrier to try and bring two nuclei together and release nuclear energy. The two nuclei are not just a single charge, you know, a charged object. It's as if they are fluctuating the whole time, and at any given instant they can actually be attractive rather than repulsive. They have structure, in other words.
Well, how would you compare that to, like, fourth-generation nuclear energy? Are they starting to look at that stuff, or are they still...
No.
They're not in the ballpark.
No, their belief system, they tossed out cold fusion because it wasn't in their belief system. This is a kind of warm fusion, you might call it. But there's a French scientist. There are people along the way, and this has been the interesting part, is discovering the people who've made the real breakthroughs but are not yet recognized. You know, the history of science in future will look quite different to what's being taught now because there'll be a whole lineup of different people. And one of them was Professor Louis Kervran, who showed that biological systems are able to transmute elements from one to another at body temperature. And He actually found that by experiments done with French legionnaires in the desert who were having sodium tablets, you know, the salt tablets, which is standard fare in the heat of the desert. But they were taking in salt, sodium atoms, and excreting potassium. And he said, hang on a minute, how does that work? And then he looked at the nuclear table and found out that potassium actually absorbed energy. The switch from sodium to potassium, the energy levels were such that it was taking energy away, in other words, reducing temperatures in the body. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, you've really got to look at seriously, not just say, no, I don't believe it, or, you know, there must be some other way of looking at it. The thing is, you've got to actually look at it.
Mm-hmm. Have an open mind, and if these things are working out in the labs, then why are we not looking at it? It would be almost like removing an anchor from humanity, and we could start to look at stuff. That's how probably how you see it.
Yeah,
I don't like seeing scientists being oppressed when they have good ideas. It bothers me that there's so much politics in science.
That's
right.
And
there's so much ego in science.
Yeah, it's too easy to associate somebody with a good idea with all of the people who've come up with cranky ideas, and there's plenty of them, of course.
Exactly.
To be a scientist, you need to have a look carefully and try and think if there's any way that what's being presented could be tested, if you feel it's worth testing, to see whether there's something that should be could be useful or could change the way we look at the world. At present, unless it fits the belief system, you're in trouble. A famous astronomer, Halton Arp, who unfortunately died just a few years ago, will be recognized in future as the father of modern cosmology, that is, of the electric universe, once we get there. His opinion of science, because he'd suffered at their hands because of his discoveries, is that it's more like a medieval guilds, you know, where you had to conform to the guild's rules and everything, otherwise you were out. And this is a pretty sad commentary.
But that's not how science should be, right? It's not the opinions of a small group, but it's the science should be come out and you debate it and you look at what the outcomes of testing and labs and all that stuff. And then if it shows that it doesn't work, well then, okay, we'll take our pieces and go home because you showed us it doesn't work. But until you get to that point, it doesn't make it. I don't. Yeah, it that's why it disturbs me so much, because it's really hurting a lot of holding people back and hurting good people by laughing at them and whatever. You know, there are cranks and quacks and stuff, but you don't have to laugh at them. You just show why their stuff doesn't make sense.
That's right, Jess. You don't call them names and dismiss them. Yeah.
Yeah, you just show it doesn't work. Not a big deal. Congrats for trying and putting a theory together. And I don't mean to be patronizing because that's what we should be doing. But you suddenly call them a crank and a quack. Just say, hey, their theories don't make sense. But you got to do it you can't just say someone's a crank and a quack and not do that.
No. In fact, there was a report, a fairly recent report, which looked at the science, real science benefits of government-sponsored and funded science compared with that done within companies where scientists have more freedom. They got practically no value for money out of the government-funded science. It all came from the big companies like Bell Lab and whatnot in the past.
Yeah, there's a lot that came out of that.
Exactly. So this funneling of huge sums of money into government-funded science has really been counterproductive. And it also sets up bureaucracies and, you know, all these kinds of things which sort of harden the arteries of science. And that's the real problem, I think. The Thunderbolts project works quite differently. It works on the old Renaissance model, where if you can come up with a convincing set of arguments and inspire somebody with the money or the equipment or whatever to test those ideas, then that's the way you do science. And this is what's happened. In fact, we have a number of people in their garages around the world doing experiments to show that a lot of the features on the Earth and Mars and the Moon and so on are actually electrical scars, and they're nothing to do with what geologists think. And this gets down to the problem that the specialism in science ruins trying to build a big picture, because each one develops their own specialized language, so that somebody outside that specialty can't even converse with them sensibly. Mm-hmm. And also the focus, they get more and more focused on some small trivial aspect of their work, because that's all that's available to them, instead of having this big picture which says, okay, if I go down the hall and talk to somebody in this department, maybe they can help me. They don't do that. In fact, even within the one department, and I had a lot of experience as IBM's representative at the National University here for some years, where people who disagreed with each other in one discipline will not read the other one's work. You know, it's that bad.
That's what Adam Smith said, is if the more specialized you become, the dumber, you'll create the dumbest people that you'll ever see if we just completely specialize.
Yes.
You know, in Wealth of Nations, he was saying we cannot get there. We're just completely specialized.
Yes. Halton Arp said something similar to say in regard to the more training you get, the less useful you are in astronomy. He found the most useful people for him were amateurs. He could ask amateurs to look at objects in the sky and look for connections between them, and they would do it, no questions asked. But the specialists wouldn't do it. In fact, NASA would publish pictures where they actually set the exposure so that you couldn't see the connections, because that would have challenged their view of what this thing was or the relationships between them. It really is a psychological problem, and it means that scientists need to have a broader education. They need to understand themselves and the way the brain works. The brain works to suppress things which don't appear on the map that you've been given since you were born. In fact, you can be quite blind to them, not even be able to see it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and at least some of the teaching now and some of the talking, you hear people talk about it, really get out of your box, go and go to different disciplines, learn different disciplines, because you're going to bring that back and be better in your discipline. Because if you're only thinking with one paradigm, you're not going to...
That's right.
The Adam Smith concept, you know?
Yeah. The problem today is that there is no university that teaches the big picture, because nobody's going to step out there and do that. But if you have a big picture, then everyone in that university can see where their part of it fits and its relationship to others. At present, there is no connection between nuclear physics and biology. There should be, but there isn't, you know, and connections between the life sciences and geology and the hard sciences, so to speak.
But we
the
need
connections
that.
Are just not there. We need it.
And with our technology going so much farther into the, you know, there's a tsunami of technology coming. All fields are crossing. If you really want to, and without doing things that are going to damage us. We're not going to understand the ramifications.
Good point.
Yeah, we're not going to get it unless we start looking at the big picture across disciplines.
That's a very good point. Technology advances, as I said, without having to know the science behind something. In other words, they find something in the lab that works and then they can apply it. But that means we're being treated as lab rats the whole time by the medical industry, you know, the drug industry, by the people who produce the chemicals we throw on our food. All of this kind of stuff is just using us as lab rats.
And not because they mean to all the time, right? It's because they aren't looking at the ramifications of different things.
They're not taught the bigger picture. They can't see that what they're doing could have an impact over here and over there and actually be not a good idea. It is rather dismaying, actually, to be alive at this stage and see what technology is being used for, because a lot of it is counterproductive or actually inimical to our survival. That's what I say. The big picture is the important thing to have.
So I have to have you back another time, and you're going to talk about what kind of technology. I'll give you time to think about that talk. What kind of what kind of technology are we doing that's a detriment to our survival? Because that would actually be very useful, right, to have something that we really think about that.
Well, what I should say is that we have a multi-million-dollar experiment going on right now to test the electrical model of stars, and the fallout of that could be enormous. On the other hand, having worked out how gravity works, I'm now thinking about how that could be applied. So I've developed I'm developing a simple laboratory test to check the idea out.
Well, and I hope they actually start taking this stuff seriously. Now, you're saying the electrical engineers are really taking it seriously. They're looking in the labs. They're the professional organizations. So
a number of them are, yeah.
Is that starting to penetrate out? Because that's a very but that's a very respected industry, right?
Of course.
It's very, because it's the backbone of all computing and so much of the stuff we do. So I would think it would start to penetrate out.
Well, I attended several of the IEEE Plasma Sciences conferences in the US, and the only time I met an astronomer there was a radio astronomer, and he was working together with Anthony Perrett, whom I mentioned earlier, looking at the radio signals from space near the solar system, and he was decoding what he was seeing in terms of electric currents flowing through space. And the evidence that he found was practically incontrovertible. But astronomers don't go near it.
That's too bad. They should at least look at the different disciplines. It's a very respected field. And why wouldn't you at least look at it and see how it applies to what you're doing, especially if it's going to solve so many of your issues that you can't figure out right now?
That's right.
But right? Come on.
This is one of the strange things. You see, the people there now in physics think they can sit in front of a computer screen and make models. And if the model, they can make a model that looks something like what they observe, then they say, "Eureka, I found it." That is not the way to do science because it's a kind of virtual reality. You can make up almost anything you like, you know, do your own avatars in front of a computer screen. And it's rather telling when you look at these control rooms for the Large Hadron Collider and that, and everyone is looking at a room full of these screens, all reflecting back to them what they put in. In other words, all they will see is what they put in. They won't see the truth.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem with just doing computer modeling, right?
Absolutely.
You're only going to put in what the person programmed.
Yep. Having worked in the computer industry all my working life, I know all about that.
Well, yeah, in my background, I'm a computer engineer, computer software. So I, that's the way it works. It's not magic. It's only as good as the people that programmed it. And they can't possibly understand all the ramifications and all the, you know, I suppose maybe millions of years from now, maybe we'll get it figured out. But not right now.
We have to start teaching kids by presenting them with alternatives to think about. Not just this is the story, this is the genius, this is the universal law, blah, blah, blah. Say, you know, when Einstein put his theory forward, these were some of the arguments against it. Go away and read them and tell me what you think,
Yeah, and then come up with the ability to think about things, formulate your own ideas, the critical thinking that we really need so that we can progress, right? I mean,
That's right.
We need that. So how can people learn more about what you're doing? So fascinating.
The thunderbolts.info website is our major outlet. My personal one is holoscience, holoscience.com. But most of my work now is directed at the thunderbolts.info website. So mine is more of historical interest now than to see the development of ideas. But the latest stuff, including our conferences, which are now live streamed each year, all of the videos and that are up on that thunderbolts.info website.
And people should look at it. And you're very open. If somebody can show you that one of your ideas doesn't work, you guys are very open to that, because then you might want to look at it differently, right?
Oh, sure. Yes.
That's the difference. You bring bring them all on. Take us on. That's what we're looking for. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the time, Sarah.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And that's all we have for today. You can listen to this again. Go to my website, sarahwestall.com. There's also the YouTube video that is up there with him on that as well. I want to remind you to please subscribe to my newsletter and to the YouTube. It really helps support the show as we have more subscribers. Also on YouTube, please like it. I guess likes matter as far as YouTube showing it to other people. I also on my channel, I have shows that are too sensitive for YouTube that they won't monetize it. It's kind of sad. It's anything that's too political for them or is a controversial issue, they won't monetize it. And there's a lot less views then that go to that. So I have that separated so people can see what those are. And I want to remind you that you can get my podcast on 100 now, different streaming and podcast channels. And I've just been added to a lot more streaming channels. So you can get me anywhere, iHeart, iTunes, all the major podcast channels. And also it airs nationwide and in Canada on the Global Star satellite. Also on Transformation Talk Radio, it's available there 7 days a week as well. So you will be able to find it wherever you're looking. Closing, I want to tell you to have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.